Clubhouse.
Welcome back to another episode of Tales from the Shogunate, a Shogun Companion podcast. This is for the eighth episode called The Abyss of Life. This is Paul, here with Gabby and Inez. How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm ready. I'm excited about this one.
Charged up?
Yeah. Excited about everyone, Inez.
This one made my stomach twist.
Gave it the old Hiramatsu.
It's too soon, Paul. It's too soon. Feels disrespectful still. Come on.
He was a good guy. He was a solid contributor to the team. All right. Gabby, you ready to hit the synopsis for this episode?
Affirmative, sir.
All right. We start this episode with the entire Toranaga entourage moving from the fishing village to Edo to perform the funeral and mourning period for Naga, who did not survive last week's episode.
Right. And then Ishido decided to surprise us all and pop the question to Lady Ochiba.
Bro didn't even bring a ring or nothing. Let's see. Then we had the funeral. We had a procession where a lot of stuff happened. They were supposed to be wearing, I guess, your formal robes, and others decided to wear their full armor. That was a thing. And meanwhile, Yabu gets his orders that he's supposed to leave early in front of Toranaga's entourage to arrive in Osaka with his cannons and his rifles.
And then Father Albedo shows up again and advises Toranaga to team up with Lady Ochiba. So that conversation didn't go well, though.
Yeah, when you're not allowed to speak the language anymore, you're not allowed to, like, dirty the language by it coming out of your mouth. That's a change.
I liked that.
The husband of the year, Buntaro, tries to make up with Mariko.
Over matcha tea, so that was special because matcha tea is the, like, best tea that they have. So it was a nice little ceremony. I enjoyed it. Followed by our boy Blackthorn finally met up with his crewmates, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. I'll discuss some of the differences in that scene with the book. After that, though, Blackthorn tries to ally himself with Yabu, but Yabu, at least under the watchful gaze of Omi, was not able to agree with Blackthorn right then.
And then one of the lighthearted parts of this episode was when the church folk and future geisha team realized that they were neighbors. Toranaga gave them plots of land side by side to each other.
Needed just a small amount of balance for the heavyweight stuff happening in this episode. Yeah. Because right after that, we have the big meeting. Toranaga called all the men, all the leaders to come in and attest to their fealty. So they had the big meeting in Edo, which ended with the tragic suicide of Hiramatsu.
Right. And then Lady Ochiba got back to Ishido, and she seems like she said yes to that proposal.
Seems like it. I mean, she didn't verbalize it, but yeah. I missed a bullet here, but there's the Falcon Room scene with Toranaga and Mariko, where he reveals he knows everything that's going on everywhere, and he's decided how he's going to spend Mariko.
And then finally, we get back to our guy Yabu, or my guy Yabu and Blackthorn, and find out that they now are allies on the ship. What's to come? Very exciting.
Okay, guys. Something about the train of horses and men moving down the road reminded me of other things that I have seen in that same way. That I won't mention their name because we're not supposed to. But there was a piece of lore about those people whose name rhymed with Rothraki.
Oh my god.
that made it so that if your leader fell off his horse, then he wasn't your leader anymore. And I know that that's not necessarily transferable to the universe of reality in feudal Japan, but Torinaga was giving me some vibes there. Like, he wasn't going to make it. Did you guys buy it, or did you think it was an act?
You know, I initially believed that maybe this is part of his long game. You know, I think, you know, he's really good now, so I can't trust what performance he's giving me and what I'm seeing just from face value in person here. So I was not convinced right away. That did change and fluctuate throughout the episode.
Definitely at this point, I thought, well, the one thing that I can trust is that I don't trust anything I see on the screen. So that's why it was opposite day for me.
The trickster.
And not a chance. Yeah.
And you know, and so I have this like also this kind of weird thing that I notice. I don't know. I don't think that it's intentional for anything. It's just kind of like a fun pattern that I notice that every single time I would see the subtitles come off and I would hear the coffee noise, it was never like on his face. It was always like just like the, you know, post-production sound added to it. But I was interpreting it. Maybe this is kind of giving the most subtle kind of hints that this is like a trickery or something. Maybe there's an intentional mm-hmm. way that they edited this to put the sound mm-hmm. always when you don't see it. Even though I think there was only one scene the entire episode where I did actually see him do a cough. Other than that, it's just been him kind of like limping and weak or whatever and needing support. But all of the coughing moments, like 99% of them, I had noticed the pattern that it was always not on his face. And I don't know why the editing ended up like that. Just a fun little pattern I picked up.
You think maybe like during editing, they're like, we can't hear the cough. And then they're like, schedule Hiroyuki Sanada to come in and do a cough session. And he had to like loop his own cough to be like,
maybe you know what? They wasn't sick enough. Maybe the original one didn't have the cough in it and they didn't record it with coughing. And maybe that could be why.
Like stage cougher.
He's a very beautiful man. So
he's always projected strength. So he didn't know how to project weakness.
Right. But one thing I thought Inez was going to say, and I do want to add, is that those subtitles, though, when he was coughing, it said, Torinaga speaking Japanese, cough. So it was a Japanese cough.
They had to edit a Japanese cough specifically in there for us.
I realized that every single time it said like Japanese cough, that it was Torinaga's cough.
I didn't watch it with closed captions. I just watched it with like the normal on-screen captions that they do built in for the Japanese translation. So I didn't get to enjoy that.
And you know, this episode did have the English dubbed version and the Japanese version. They were slightly different. So I'm pretty sure that those closed captions were on the English one.
What did you make of the funny look that Torinaga gave to Blackthorne after Blackthorne had offered his condolences for Naga?
I was really curious about that. How I'm going about watching these episodes now are just like face value, because I don't know what Torinaga is up to, but I knew that he's up to something. So I don't know if it was something like annoyed at him, because he did seem sentimental in this episode, which was unique. I thought he would somehow have like a poker face. I didn't think that he would show that much sadness and disappointment for his son. So I really appreciated that. So that said, I think that it was probably, I don't know, because I don't want to say he was vulnerable, but maybe he was being vulnerable.
I think he was. Yeah, I think it's fair to say he was vulnerable.
He's impressed that Blackthorne is like somewhat being like the son that his son couldn't be, because he has finally switched over. He's assimilating a lot better.
A theme that I picked up on in this episode was that this was like the men's show. This was like all of the men, mm-hmm. now they're really facing death, and mm-hmm. you're seeing that openness and the vulnerability and a teeny tiny bit more transparency and even like boldness in these conversations and exposing themselves. And so Buntaro's been the most like kind of like volatile. Yabu, you know, is kind of his own entity, but Buntaro, you know, he's kind of, we've seen his journey and he's at the end and he knows like this, everything, all of the information he knows is that he's about to die with everybody else. And you see him cry twice in this episode. You know, he's lost two people now, really. And so I felt like that this vulnerability scene among all the men is like an intentional thing. So that's why I'm saying I support that, like your instinct of wanting to say it, even though you don't, because of, I know you're mourning Hidematsu still. And I know where that anger is going toward.
Okay, so then thanks. Now, that said, yeah, I feel like maybe he was just really impressed with Blackthorn, that he's like coming around, but also annoyed that it's not like his son that came around, and just kind of doesn't want to talk about it or show his vulnerability. So he's like, get out of here. I'm not a man. I'm a god. But what did you think?
It was just a funny look. It was just a look that I couldn't quite read. It was a rich look. It wasn't as simple as a frown or a... Mm-hmm. Smile or something. It was several things at once because it lingered on camera.
Was it suspicious to you?
That's a good question. Let me reverse. Kind of.
That's what I've got.
Suspicion was one of the emotions that I got. Like I had a little surprise, a little suspicion, a tiny amount of actual like genuine gratitude kind of underlying the surprise. Okay. But yeah, it was a mixed emotion.
Yeah. Okay.
But at that point, in front of all his people, Toranaga is doing a pretty good job selling the portrait of a broken man. Dead son, coughing, wobbling around in his saddle.
Oh my God, I know. The wobble. I'm like, who the freak would believe that? Yeah, and that's when Blackthorn got his rudder back. Did you feel like he was going to jump on his ship as soon as that happened?
I think that's a pretty good guess. I mean, he's always, as far as the show, at this point in the book also, he's very much kept his eye out to sea. And the rudder was always that sort of like, it was like his own little hostage. And if he gets it back, then his connection and his obligation kind of symbolically to Toranaga is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as we'll discuss with the meeting of the crew later, he doesn't realize how much he's adapted at this point. Here he is speaking the most Japanese he's ever spoken in the show, but he doesn't quite know that that's a major shift for him.
Right. But then, I mean, right after, you know, he received his rudders, he did ask Mariko if she, like, what her plans were as his translator, and she didn't say that she didn't want to go with him. She just said something about her loyalty to her lord means she has to stay, and then walks away with that. So there's some of that forbidden love theme in this episode that was bittersweet.
Just as a reminder, the book version of them is they are not open about their relationship, but they are sneaking around at night, if you catch my drift.
Oh, still at this point. Interesting. Yeah. That seems out of character, like, to the culture, especially considering that if they got caught, they would die. And now they know that.
Blackthorn didn't have so much of a problem with it. And Mariko, that's why the scene with Buntaro coming up is so wacky. I think I mentioned it last week, like, in terms of I didn't know how that they would work that scene in. And here they did. Because it was set right in the middle of the Blackthorn-Mariko romance. Complex. I'll give him that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. But like real quick in this scene also, right? Isn't this where Yabu is talking to his like aid guy?
And yeah, I think that's right. Omi just overheard what he was talking about.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That was... I mean, what did you think about that? How he was ranking the deaths and he's like, make sure you write this down. One below boiling, but still above dogs, like being eaten by dogs.
Yabu's got a yabu, right?
Oh my gosh. I loved that this episode had so many full circles and we got to see everybody, right? Except for Fuji. We didn't see her, but I think everyone else made it on screen. And so I liked seeing them all interacting with each other, like out in the open, instead of, you know, just like in certain ceremonies or dinner or conference with Toranaga.
I think Fuji got to stay with the house. I think that's how that went down. Oh, right. But I'm not positive. It could be possible that we just haven't seen her. She didn't have a role in this just yet. All right. So from the entrance to Edo, that's where we flip over to Osaka and get to see Ishido shoot his shot with Ochiba.
The last episode, right, she, and actually the, since she was introduced like a couple episodes ago or a few, she was so powerful, right? And so this scene was great and sad to me because all of her power went away. Like I had asked before how she had this power, like what was it that gave her not just the empowerment, but like actual authority. And Ishido apparently just gave her all the authority because he wanted to get in her pants. Like it's really that simple. And so him proposing to her was kind of like that quid pro quo thing. It's like, okay, cool. Like at this point we can go on with what you're doing, but you know, you're also mine. So it kind of, she seemed really defeated and realized that now she has to change her strategy. But we saw the other side of the coin for Lady Ochiba, which is what I gathered from watching that. What about you?
That is quite a shift. And who's got the upper hand there? I wonder what mentally changed for Ishido, where, you know, he was pretty well taking her counsel as an order in the previous couple of episodes. And now he's reduced her to, you know, I've always liked you.
I don't think that he was doing it to like reduce her intentionally. I think he really is just a plaything that's just like his wearing his heart on his sleeve. He was so vulnerable in this episode, and just when he's around her, it's crazy.
Without this proposal, does she still harbor all of this authority that we've seen her execute since she's come in, right? As a full force, we saw Ishido shrink. Now he's kind of standing, he's kind of like Twitter-pated a bit, look the way he's looking at her with that very slight gaze and smile. What does this arrangement change for her? Because even he proposes and it does kind of seem like there is like an actual attraction that may be from respect. But if they do get engaged and do get married and just announcing it to everybody, how does that solidify like his place in here? And by him marrying, we know that the marriage dynamic means that the woman is now like a property and by default lower. So, you know, I saw like a fear in her eyes. And a lot of away gazes. It wasn't as much of like that really intentional eye contact that she had been making previously. There was a lot more eye diversion from this. And it actually looked like, was she afraid or was she just annoyed? And so then I was just looking for that moving on into the episode for like her follow-up scenes to kind of determine what is her state of mind. Because I feel like she has a lot to lose if she accepts this proposal. But I'm under the impression right now that for whatever reason, she has more power right now as a single woman. And is it because the Taiko's wife passed and then that is what shifts and takes away her current standing authority? So those are the kind of questions that I wrote down as a result from this conversation.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely think that she was afraid and she knew this was coming, but didn't want it to. And yeah, her being, I mean, I guess we said before that she is Taiko's mom. And so that's her only power, that Taiko's she has to mom. Protect him. Taiko's baby Taiko. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Future Taiko. And yeah, Taiko's heir's mom. And so yeah, absolutely, as soon as a man comes in, she's his property. And I think that at this point, I don't think that Taiko's wife had died, right?
No, later.
Yeah, that happens later. And so at this point, she just knows that he's starting to come in. And absolutely, he being the father or stepfather of baby Taiko automatically puts him in the power position of being Taiko's guardian, you know, so they don't have to like do this regent stuff as much because there's this huge alliance and now he's secured. I think it also makes her like puts a target on her back too, because he is a regent and there is going to be a war and she knows it. So she's not a puppet master anymore.
I'll accept all that, because all I put in my notes was gives a weird look in response. So I'd rather have it identified as an actual look than a weird look. And, I can see where finally, you know, having to marry somebody must have been a reality for her, but the kind of the step back in status, she's still Tycho Air's mom, but she's also wife.
So to me, it seems like, why would she be incentivized to accept this proposal if she has this standing authority right now? So have I just not been given a clear picture of like her status and authority now? Like, was I intended to make me think that she did have so much more power, like where she can bring Ishido down to be minimal? It just feels like a interesting, like sudden kind of shift. Like, I don't see why she would be afraid if she's like already is like in a superior role. And so a proposal to me would be like, fuck off, you know?
Well, clearly you've never seduced a man and then tossed him out, because that's what it was. She never actually had any power. It was just like that attraction. It was just a man being a man, and then
but it was following the lady and letting her take the lead. So she wasn't above them.
She was just above Ishido, and Ishido is the one who has the power, and he's the one who laid it down with the rest of the regents. They did not respect her. They just had to respect him, and he wanted her.
Okay, and then he's like, this is my card now. So, like, basically, this is like all you got. You want to keep continuing.
But you're right. What would incentivize her to actually make that change? It seems like you'd want to keep...
If she had a choice.
If she had a choice.
What if she... Yeah. So she refuses to marry him. Does that mean, like, he's going to say, actually, never mind, we're going to reverse all your plans and do what we want?
He can, yeah.
Like that's the power dynamic. Okay, I'm just asking for clarity, because I'm, like, was confused that I'm, like, okay, in my mind, when I've been putting in the entire, like, government infrastructure...
in it. She's just a behind-the-scenes... actor, an influential person, but no actual governmental power. Authority. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it was historically as well. This wasn't the dynamic between her and Ishido, but between her and her son at some point. She just had that bad taste in her mouth about Toronaga. And so she did historically like dislike Toronaga and want to sway whoever she was talking to. And, you know, in real life, the person she's supposed to be like based off of, that person didn't like Tokugawa, which is Toronaga's real base version.
That didn't work out for her in reality. Spoiler alert.
Not in real. Oh yeah, no, the real. I can't wait for all this to be over so we can, I guess, talk about the historical stuff, which right. I guess we can now, because I mean, it's totally different from this,
and it's 400 years old, so it's
so anyone can find it. No real spoiler. Right. Yeah, no, it didn't work out for her. It didn't work out for a lot of people.
Let's see, moving back to Edo, we have a men's discussion where they're eulogizing Naga together. No Toranaga there. I don't know if that's his decision or tradition, or if that empty seat was supposed to be Toranaga's seat, but the men all have stories to tell. What I'd like to focus on first, though, was Omi and his response. Omi didn't necessarily have a lot of like on-screen action per se, but they sure cut to his disapproving face a lot in this scene and other scenes. What's your read on Omi here, starting with this scene and then throughout the episode?
Oh gosh, Omi, that's funny and that's great, because I do see his face and I really did appreciate his facial expressions.
Yeah, well, and you know, he's starting to not feel it with Toranaga right then, but he's conflicted because he's supposed to.
Well, he does flip-flop a little bit, right? He does keep you on his on your toes regarding like who he's going to ally with. And I did appreciate that. I appreciated his perspective because he's the next generation and he hasn't seen battle like everyone else. And, you know, he kind of caused this with Naga, and you're just seeing his guilt and his internal accountability and reality check, where he's kind of like leveled up into manhood. I didn't know where his allegiance would be. And then at the very, you know, at the end, I think it ended up being for Toranaga, which, like, that's, I guess, when he decided to stand up and stand on his own two feet and go against Yabu. So yeah. I think his dynamic now, it's significant that he has this disapproval face, because every episode before this is just he has like an eager to impress face.
He's a company
like, man. Very young, childlike. Yeah. And now he's a man. That was kind of his first death. Like he probably put Naga in that situation. And so, yeah, I think it was really important that they panned to him. And I do have his face like embedded in my head. So he did well. And he has a good face. So it was great and terrible at the same time.
Yeah, my take on Omi has been very different. When I see his face, he does such a great job of just showing his feelings. He's like, you see his repression, but like you clearly see like he is in that like stage of like he's in the early ages of really mastering the suppression. So we get to see his feelings. So I feel like he feels a lot, and he is actually really empathetic. And I just kind of picking back off of what Gabby had said in a couple of episodes prior, this is a major change in his life and he's not feeling it. He's not super on board and he's really scared. And he's just like really wants to go back to how things were, like just really emotionally like vested in like, can we, like, please get back to, how can I get back to this kind of thing? And so just knowing that that's kind of the baggage that he's carrying going into this, I just feel like he's learning firsthand how these things are working and how, especially at this kind of stage of defeat and what that means to people and his kind of real face to like a pending death, and he's afraid. And I think that he has his ideas and he shares those with Nagakado, but I think I feel less about him being influential and trying to get other people like to do stuff. I feel like he's probably more immature than that at this stage, and he's much more like, these are my feelings and I'm expressing them to a friend who is eager, and also that immature like mindset, and they both just like action things differently. So I feel like I mean, Nagakado's fate and everything is 100% his accountability. I'm not going to put that on Omi. I think he's just trying to figure out the balance of survival and also like dealing with like this fear and like sadness that he's got on him now.
Interesting, because a while back, you know, he's the one who did say that he had a plan that he introduced to Yabu. And then every time that they have been talking to Toranaga, like, has been accepting Omi's feedback. So Toranaga does, like, respect that Omi is observant and a good strategist. But I took him being more, like, powerful in this episode. Sure, he was sad and it was somber, but to me, he seemed to have much more confidence. He outgrew this little...
He definitely morphed. Like,
woe is me thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially at the end. He morphed because of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just saying, like, I was just kind of thinking that he was a more evolved in kind of this scheming whatever, but I think it's more innocent than that. I kind of added, like, a layer of something to him that I think he's actually a little bit notch lower. But yeah, I agree. Like, and then the result of this, when you have to make a decision, this is he's resulting in his growth in this next level of manhood or stage of what the fate is of Japanese men.
Right. So in that scene, though, in this first scene, he's the one who did kind of call out Toranaga for surrendering. Right. He's the first person to poison the air with the betraying him or the betraying Toranaga or doubting his strategy or whatever, disrespecting him because they're saying that he's he was going to surrender, because he basically said that, you know, Naga is in this position because Toranaga surrendered. Like, the blood is on Toranaga's hands because Naga couldn't handle that. And he was doing Toranaga's job for him. Like, that was a big moment where everybody kind of looked around, because they're thinking like, oh man. So I thought, okay, when everyone looked around and looked at him, I know Hiromatsu obviously was like, this guy is, at least for me, when Hiromatsu looked, everyone's gazing and suspicious of each other. To me, it was that he's thinking like, okay, now the seed has been planted and who is about to start like betraying as well. But then later on, he seems to flip-flop. Like, even though he said that part, that's dissing on Toranaga, he also is, you know, saying that Yabu needs to stick to Toranaga and like be loyal. So you are seeing that even though he's expressing himself and his grief, he still is loyal to Toranaga. And at the very end, like, he's remained loyal, which I didn't know which way it would go. And he stuck around.
Do you suppose he did that because Yabu sided with Blackthorn right then?
Blackthorn.
And so he thought that was the more disgusting route of the two?
I mean, yeah, maybe, because Yabu's the one who's been, you know, grooming him to like super hate this person. But at the end of the day, it was his choice, and he is deciding like what, you know, up until now, he's been trying to be like Yabu's apprentice. And now he's decided like which values he's going to hold on to and which he's not. We saw them kind of reverse, right? Yabu now is the carefree one, and he's the get down to business. Omi is the get down to business loyal one. So that was an interesting switch. I can't wait until we talk about Yabu. But in that conversation for the morning, I mean, Buntaro, it was interesting because Buntaro said that he was brave. Yeah. And then Hiromatsu said that he was reckless, and Omi was the friendly present guy. He always gives the present perspective, and it was really sweet that he said he would enjoy being here. And so we got different points of view, different perspectives of who Naga was, and I really did appreciate that, because it was actually sad when Omi said that. I did like see Naga like sitting there, and maybe that's why they had the empty chair too. I just, in my head, like, I put him there, and I had this little like montage like ghost thing happening in that scene. So thanks, Omi.
The next couple of scenes are dedicated to the funeral procession and the funeral itself, which Toranaga watches from a distant rooftop. But it's during that procession that we see a couple of things. One is they tell us that the men wearing the full armor are doing so in protest to Toranaga's expected surrender. And then there's also a sidebar discussion between Yabu and Hiromatsu about the state of things. And that's when Yabu gets his orders to escort the cannons and the guns to Osaka ahead of Toranaga's host. Or I guess it's, I don't know if it's a host, they're not going to war, but you get the idea. I've been saying entourage, but I wanted to change it up a little bit with a new word.
No, so I did love about this episode that they had a lot of cultural components where we, you know, got to have a little bit more insight of like ceremonies. So we do see them in different outfits and we do see a different side of them. I think that scene, along with some others, were just meant to be like a nice, informative, educational situation, especially because everyone that we're seeing in, we haven't seen anyone mourn or grieve for anything. There's been no time. Like, someone dies, it's like you talk about it, they're somewhere sadly like in like a mass grave or something, because it's been really big, like horrific events, and this is the first time that it was just one person. Yeah. And so I feel like this was like a long overdue, slow paced mourning scene. And then it does like cut out, right? Where there's the smoke just going into the air, and then the camera pans out, and that's when you see Toranaga watching it. And so I think that could represent like the powerful like impact, the big loss that like everyone's feeling, also like the vast like emptiness, and then also figuratively reinforcing Toranaga's advice to Naga, or which was telling him that like when like, you can't trust anybody because when you're on the top, you're always by yourself. You're always alone. You're the loneliest person. And we saw that. We had that imagery where he can't even, like, be present to mourn his son, which we do know that he is deeply mourning because his son's the only person that we can visually, like, actually see get under his skin. So, yeah, I thought that scene was just really beautiful and respectful to, like, the death and the emotions and repression, I guess, behind it.
If I was more cultured, I could point out, like, what aspects of the ceremony belong to what part of Japanese culture and religion. One thing that they don't dwell on in the show, but they expound on in the book, is how religion is not all one thing in Japan, not usually anyway, where a person can adhere to the beliefs and core values, I guess, of several religions at once and not consider it any kind of, you know, conflicting point of view. So you may get Shinto mm-hmm. things, you may get Buddhist things, and you may get Christian things all at once, and it's not a big deal. And that even is the case as far back as 1600.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was probably showing us that, just adding the perspective that at the end of the day, all that matters is that this ceremony and ritual is meant to prepare them for their last journey in the utmost care and respectful way.
So another aspect of this scene ties back to something I mentioned at the end of last week's podcast, where I mentioned that in this point in the book, Torinaga decided to stall. Remember, we were wondering, well, how is he going to, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. How is he going to get his army? And he doesn't have enough time. If he's escorted directly to Osaka from where he was last week, then what? And this is a very intriguing way to do something like the book, but do it in a much more cutthroat way. They did not kill his son in the book. Naga was a character, but they didn't use him this way. Here, they kill him so that he in effect, gets to stall. He gets to go to Edo, where his seat of power is, all built into the mourning process. Wow. I'm just in awe, I guess, of that writing decision to turn like that. Makes me kind of thrilled for what might come next if they were so beastly with this one single plot point.
Well, what happened in the book? How did they stall in the book?
He does what he does here. He pretends to be sick.
Ah, so he is pretending.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, so I guess this is definitely more realistic then.
Probably, but still, gosh. I guess there's a point where certain characters in the book become sort of unimportant. They don't finish out any major arc or anything like that. And they are spent in the show fatally. Like, especially in this episode and last episode.
What happened to his son in the book?
He's just part of the group. He's just part of, no big deal. He's barely mentioned past,
you stop hearing about him at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I really appreciate the writing in this episode. Like Gabby mentioned, this episode lended itself to a lot of cultural education. These are my favorite moments of what draws me to Shogun. I love this education around it. And I think the other added layer on top of all of the detail regarding how people are opening and closing their windows, opening and closing doors, doing the tea ceremony, doing this funeral procession. We also got to see the reinforcement of the preparation, all of that in Osaka when Taiko's wife passed. I think, and then just the beauty and cleanliness and streamline of all of these beautiful flowing vibes that they're giving me here, intentionally setting me up for my reaction when we end up meeting Blackthorn with his crew. So I think that the intention, there's a lot of intentionality in this writing style to give you the education, to bring you a lot of peace, and then they fucking gut you later on and shock you in those other moments. And I think that those really were extra strong because of the beauty and serenity that they gave me during these moments.
Oh yeah, excellent, excellent writing. This is a masterpiece. Yeah, so that beautiful scene, it was a change of pace, and it was really somber And shortly after that, we got to meet the baby, right? Totonaca's baby or his
grandbaby. This was the baby that was born off camera at the very beginning of the show when Ochiba was taken on as a guest in Edo, because after all, she is sister to the woman that had the baby.
Yes, that was such a cute baby, and our Mariko smiled and looked so happy holding that baby. So that lasted just a moment, but it was wonderful for me.
Oh yeah.
Though in this scene, though, right, Mariko seemed pretty suspicious about why like Totonaca hadn't seen the baby, and I feel like in a lot of this episode, her suspicious face, I think, was probably because she... I mean, well, do you think that she felt like something was going on? That he... Do you think she suspected that he was plotting something? That it was just so unusual of him to not show up even if he's sick?
I didn't necessarily get stink lines from that. What I got was the part where she said that her family was going to be spared the Totonaca family purge following the trip to Osaka. And Mariko, she didn't react like, oh, good, that's terrific. I don't know why you would have that exact reaction either, but kind of like a play group of moms. I mean, she knows she's going to die. Right. Oh, that's terrific. But still, that's where I got the suspicious face with that bit of news before Buntaro came in, was like, hey, what's going on in here?
Yeah, he did sound just like that. Really good imitation, you, Paul. Like that?
I've been working on my Buntaro.
Yeah, and he's like, hey lady, you want to have some tea, some of the specialty matcha tea? I was actually hopeful that they were going to have some kind of like moment like the book, you know. Well, you referenced that they professed their love to each other.
Yeah, the scene kind of started the same, but the setting was completely different. And then it ended completely different when Mariko twists it and says, I'd rather live 1,000 years than die with you. Because the way they view death is like this beginning of another journey. So if you do it with another person, then you start that journey together. Yeah. And she would rather put so much distance between herself and him on that journey than do it right now. I didn't see it coming in. I was like, yes, when she did that.
Yeah, that is a little bit ahead. But yeah, that was a nice moment. I was mostly happy to hear that she said, I don't actually want to die. I just don't want to be around you. That made me happy. And I'm like, well, I know you're going to die anyway, but like, yay. It's the anger in there. It's not like deep sadness, I guess. This whole time I thought she wanted to die because she was like sad about her family, but really she just hates her husband, which is so sad.
That's relatable.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. More. I don't want to make a joke and just sound terrible to my husband. So I just won't do that. Never mind. Some morbid jokes over here. But I mean, he was sad. He looked like he was like,
oh, I mean, didn't he cry at the end of that?
Yeah. But you know what? Buntaro, I have to give it to him. The actor, the writing, holy cow. My flip flopping for this man. I love him. I hate him. I love him. I hate him. It's like, it's just even this in this episode, it was just, I'm for him and then I'm against him. Like, I have to remember that I hate him. He's amazing. This is just great writing that everybody is just so flawed, but also still somewhat likable. Except, you know, Mariko keeps it real and consistent.
Do you think it's like a similar thing to what Omi is going through, where he's like facing this honor-bound mortality and that's triggering these new emotions that he's having to reconcile and deal with?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's happening with everybody. And so we're just seeing how that's manifesting in them. And I mean, of course, Blackthorn is pulling his usual, which is like, I'm a survivor. I just need to do something. Because as he says, doing something is better than doing nothing.
To quote him from when he stole the galley, fuck this.
Yeah. And you know what? Yabu too. Like, he's a cute little flip-flopper who ended up hanging out with Blackthorn, like really coming around, you know. They're just similar guys, and they, you know, having their bonding moment was sweet. Everybody's, their true colors are showing up. And then, yeah, like Hiromatsu, obviously. We'll get to that later, but
well, yes. Let's move forward to these Father Alvito scenes then. Both the running into Buntaro with the firewood vendor, and then later with the discussion about Christian daimyo alliances, Ochiba, etc.
You mean when he runs into Blackthorn?
Yeah, what did I say?
Buntaro.
Oh, shit. Yes, exactly right. I have BT on my notes here, and it fooled my brain. Damn it.
Keep Buntaro. All of that, though. I love it when you swear on here.
Father Alvito, we haven't seen him in a little bit, or not extensively in a little bit. I don't know why. I took particular joy in seeing Blackthorn kind of show him up with his knowledge, his new knowledge of tiny things in Japanese language.
Of tiny things. Yeah, it was cute. And it was kind of funny because up until now, he had been incredibly respectful with his translations. And this is the first time that he did call him a name. And of course, Blackthorn knew what that was about, which it was really also nice to see their change of dynamic and Blackthorn's maturity. Because, you know, before he was just like, I hate you all the time, and now he's just a guy. Like, he's just a guy living in Japan and trying to get by.
How he feels about what he calls the papists is very strong in the book, and this scene did not take place that I recall, but you get the sense like an earlier version of Blackthorn, had he met Father Alvito or another Jesuit in the wild, he might have killed him, you know. He might have, or at least had some violent reaction to their meeting, because they are enemies elsewhere in the world, the kind that kill each other. So you're right, this is a very reserved, like, I'm just gonna show you up with my knowledge of Japanese charcoal.
He did throw out that they're like they're like cockroach.
Yes,
yeah.
I loved it. It was great.
Yeah, that was adorable.
What's interesting about Blackthorn, and that we don't totally get in the show because we're not all multilingual, is that he'll go between English, Spanish, Portuguese, and Latin, depending on who he's talking to and depending on what kind of point he wants to make. So you got a taste of that right then with the cockroach. But yeah, he does that throughout.
Yeah.
Latin, yeah, especially, is something that Mariko knows. And that is their secret language of love.
Of course.
Ooh.
Yep.
That's dumb. I don't need that.
You don't have a secret language of love, Gabby?
No, I just don't want to see that here. I don't need them to continue this, like, love thing between Blackthorn and Mariko, because it just makes it way harder for what's to come.
I would say buckle up on that. I think they're building something. It looks like there might be some alone time on that boat coming up.
Oh, well, I would like that. Aw, don't put my hopes up. Stop it. It's just going to make the fall even that much harder. Okay. Anyway. You know,
I did think about that. I was just like, are they going to rock the boat now that they're out there on sea? But I don't know. But it might be easier if we get caught. But do they care anymore?
I mean, Yabu's there.
Mm.
Right. But do they care anymore?
Close to death like that? Mm, yeah.
Oh, you guys are funny. So where's Yabu gonna be watching? Anyway.
Another full circle moment. Then,
taking notes. Like, I know. He watches people die. He watches people hump.
I know.
That's how. Yeah. That's our guy. He's a scientist.
Wait to get back to that later.
He's a scientist.
The scientific method. I don't know if you guys are done talking about this.
Well, we can move forward to to the meeting, the big meeting.
Right before that, when the priest like seats Lady Maria, like that was also a kind of a nice reminder. Like they're really taking me back to the very beginning. And it's so smart because it makes it extra sentimental and like these full circle moments. And then again, you get to see this other side of Mariko that you haven't seen, who she is as Lady Maria. And she really does care for the priest. And I think he really does care for her. And I think that he is being honest about showing up and like wanting to help Toronaga. I think a lot of the reason for that is obviously because of his close relationship with Mariko, which is, you know, probably one of Toronaga's long game strategies too. because she's just like so charming that everyone's like on her side and making Torunaga an ally by proxy. But that very small scene I felt was significant. And yeah, it led right into the meeting, which was also very significant.
Yeah, well, Alvito has only bad news up front that he couldn't turn Kiyama and Ono to Torunaga's side. And that's when Torunaga strips him of the ability to speak Japanese. He won't hear it out of his mouth. In all of the shows I've ever watched about people with disparate languages, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone insult anybody like that. It forbid them to speak their language. That's a great diss.
I don't know. I feel like Gabby could do that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that because I'm like, man, I feel like I probably have done that. Thank you for just seeing me, Inez.
What language did you forbid somebody from speaking?
English.
You shut your mouth when you're talking to me.
Perfectly sane.
Yeah,
this, very normal.
This scene, it was cool to me because it reinforced the deep trust that Torunaga has for Mariko. And again, I know I was really, you know, upset about that before, how he's just has this closeness so that he can use her because she's just a really effective tool. But things have changed for me because they're all trying to like survive for the greater good. And they know that like everyone in this room, at least he, Torunaga, Hiromatsu, and Mariko, they know that they're going to die for everyone else. Like, they're walking into this prepared for that. So, seeing this trifecta of people, like, during this meeting, I thought was really important. We were talking about the three hearts, and then, you know, Blackthorn's not one of those. And so I just thought maybe it was these three now. They're our main players.
Was Hiromatsu in the conversation? He in the room here? Going along with the flip-flopping thing theme, right? I think I wrote down something from this scene where he asked Hiromatsu for advice. He's giving it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like the advice, and it shuts him up. If I wanted your advice, I would have asked for it.
Apparently, he wanted a small amount of advice, but then Hiromatsu kept giving advice. Mm-hmm. And then he didn't want any more.
He said, "What do you think?" And so he wanted to know what he thought. And then when he started giving advice, he's like, shut up.
My brain is confusing some book and show things. Have they discussed what would happen if Torunaga had an army? What would happen if the heir were to show up on the field and raise his standard? What position that would put Torunaga in? Have they mentioned that yet?
No. Well, what does that mean, raise his standard?
His flag, like, you know how they have those banners that they carry around,
right?
That show, these are Ishido's forces, these are Torunaga's forces. Mm-hmm. Well, the heir has his own flag, and Torunaga would not attack it. Even if he was on the field of battle fighting Ishido's forces, if the heir showed up and raised his flag, then he'd stop, he'd surrender.
That's interesting. They haven't discussed that.
They have, right. But you're kind of getting a taste of it here, where Hiramatsu's agreeing to this idea of, well, if you marry the heir's mom, I think the subtext is you'd kind of short-circuit Ishido's plan there to stick the heir potentially on the field of battle and forcing you to lose a battle like that, because he'd be your stepson, or I don't know how it works, if they even count steps in those arrangements, or if they just become sons. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think that's what Hiramatsu's seeing in the larger picture.
Do you think that he had already had his conversation with Torunaga about the grand plan at this point, and he was just putting out this plan as like bait for the priest to hear? Because Mariko and the priest have a close relationship and they know that. And so I think it's important. At this point, they're testing everybody and their loyalty and kind of pinning anyone against each other when it needs to happen that way. And so I was thinking that this was a staged thing. That was the vibe that I got.
That's a really good point, because we know that at this point he sends Alvito back to Osaka to tell what he had seen in Edo, which would, of course, include that discussion about, or probably include the discussion about potentially allying with Ochiba.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, I think the timing of that discussion probably precedes this discussion.
I considered that for a moment, but I decided that Hidematsu did not know what the long game plan is. I don't think that I have enough information based on what I saw here that this was part of it. I felt like Toronaga was genuinely really upset seeing this happen. Like, he has this long-term plan that he's not shared with anybody, and he has to stick to his guns to keep the facade and keep the ruse going. And the Hidematsu seppuku thing was him dealing with having to still keep that to himself. So I felt like what I saw in the eyes from that last scene was that. So that, to me, at that point when I was watching that, I kind of decided I don't think Hidematsu was part of it.
As soon as they walked out of this room, though, Hidematsu is like, okay, he's gonna fight.
He knows something,
right? I mean, okay. Either.
So you don't think it was an expressly spoken thing between the two? It was just,
well, Hidematsu knew that it was
so well. I mean, I kind of think so too, but then, you know, my stupid book reading is swaying me, because they had that discussion completely above board together where Toronaga explained what he was doing. It didn't result in Hidematsu
at this point
killing himself. At a point very near to now, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm leaning toward an actual verbal discussion. But I could see it either way, because the way he said that, where he said Hidematsu understood his duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seemed like there was a long time. And again, I think if Hidematsu didn't know something, that he wouldn't just start gossiping about it. He's just not that guy.
Right, because he's Toronaga's man.
Yeah, I mean, he's Toronaga's everything, right? He was like his mentor in the beginning, too. But anyway, right after this was our switching it up, change of pace episode with the matcha tea party.
Yeah.
Which is also really lovely to watch the ceremony, because it is a very sacred, the cultural significance of the matcha tea. It's to celebrate hospitality, harmony, and respect. And it's supposed to like connect people in the peaceful environment. So this was a really romantic gesture that he made for Mariko.
And interesting to see that he's as strict a technician with his tea ceremony pouring and whatnot as he is with his samurai skills.
It makes sense, because he's the best.
Yeah, I think that's just how it's supposed to be. But also, I think everybody, like, that's just the way to be respectful when you're having tea, because it's about the entire experience. And mm-hmm. So I think everyone learns this in adolescent years.
Did the content of this meeting surprise either one of you, or had I kind of spoiled things with the description I had given of the similar scene from the book last episode?
I was really excited for this to happen. So I think I was just eager. Part of me did want to see how they were going to play this out like the book, where somehow she would let him know some kind of positive affinity she'd have for him. But no, I think it actually was very consistent with her, and it made a lot of sense for what she said to him, which was that she just wants to stay away from him, like have an entire existence away from him. And it really made me wonder, like, all the things that we miss that he has done to her that led her to this point. And I mean, it was crazy that she said all that and then bowed to him and walked out. Like, that was a huge, huge fuck you. I think she never has told him how she felt. And she said that she does that on purpose because she doesn't want him to like feel that satisfaction or whatever. And so this, I think, was such an important moment for her and her character development. And so that's why it makes me super sad that probably very soon she's going to die, because she kind of like did the one thing that she's always wanted to do, which is a huge fuck you to her husband.
It's well executed. Almost like she had it planned. What to say. I think you mentioned the poetry in another scene. Those poems that she trades with Toronaga in those scenes are not memorized. They are thought of on the spot. Yeah. It's like a competition between the two. So yeah, she is able to come up with some great stuff verbally, extemporaneously.
What did you think, Inez?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of hints in this episode that are foreshadowing into what her duty is going to be in the next scene. It almost felt very ominous. Maybe not almost. I felt like it was a clear, ominous future for Mariko, and I'm anticipating that either next episode or the finale, like, she's going to go fulfill, like, whatever her final duty, her final act is going to be. So it makes sense that, yeah, let me go ahead and just get all this shit off my chest. That's why I'm saying that she's probably going to bang him in the boat, because, like, what else? Like, she knows that she's going, she's making her peace, and now she's just focused on the end goal here, execute, and that includes herself.
Yeah, and it was a really sad reminder of, like, women just being men's property. We know that she's a very important person to Toranaga. We also know that she is incredibly skilled and just, like, probably the smartest person here other than Toranaga. But at the end of the day, like, seeing her still know her place, stay in her place, and be so submissive and stoic, was, it's just, in this episode we heard her constantly talk about her obedience to another man, and we see, I don't know, at least I saw, like, all of her power is completely taken away. This really was a man's episode, but without the woman's presence, I guess her presence just isn't there anymore. And so that was the case for all of the women in this episode. I thought, like, the women are, their presence isn't there. They're just shells, empty shells. And then the men are just kind of, like, going through their emotions very slowly. That was a significant scene to me too. Like, it was just an extra sad reminder again, because I'm feeling, like, really good about this character, especially my women. And I'm like, yay, empowerment. And then, nope, here's a harsh reality of, like, what it actually is. Excellent writing, but it makes me sad.
This one was written, at least the credited writer, I believe, was Shannon Goss. I don't know Shannon Goss, but she's written for this, Walking Dead, Daryl Dixon, but then some very female-oriented shows, Outlander and Revenge, both female lead protagonists in those. And looks like another one called Rain, which I don't recognize, but it's only women on the poster. So, interesting juxtaposition between that, this episode, and the rest of her work. Speaking of men, Blackthorn wants to go meet up with his men. This scene is a big difference, huge difference from how things went down in the book, and changes what Blackthorn will be doing for the rest of the book, or the rest of the show, versus what he was supposed to do, or at least a large part of it. And I think that's just to speed up sort of this boring part toward the three-quarter mark of the book, I think. The meeting with the crew lasted all night. He stayed there all night. He met all the members of his crew. He hung out with them. However, he hated the experience. And what they did here was, I think, cleaner and served the purpose the same way, which, Inez, you brought up earlier, relating to how much he's changed, but especially with, like, the cleanliness of Blackthorn now. We don't see the baths so much anymore, but he bathes every day because that's the way their houses run. Whereas in the part of town where the men live, the crew, in the book they refer to those people as Eta. And that is, like, I guess, the lowest class of feudal Japan. Like, when he threw the kimono on the ground, in the book they you'll love this. They describe that he did that because it was ridden with fleas.
Oh, gosh.
And he could feel them, or at least he perceived them biting him. And that was just from hanging out in that part of town with his men. And he couldn't stand how dirty they'd be, that they'd always been. And he even reflects on what it might be like if he ever saw his wife in England again, what that would be like, knowing that she bathes once a year.
Once a year?
Yes.
No way.
Yes. Once a year.
Was that actually, like, a common thing once a year at that time?
There was belief in something called flux, which was some kind of sickness they thought that would come on to you should you bathe too often. And he even mentions that very early on in this show, you want to give me the flux?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So, yeah, they didn't bathe. And so he's actually conflicted about ever seeing his wife again, because he doesn't know if he can master this disgust that he feels for the way he used to live and his men currently.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I looked it up and it says, like, maybe once or twice a year was, like, common. That's just unreal. I thought it was like once a month. But okay, yeah. And it makes a lot of sense, though, that he would... I don't know. I guess both versions make sense as to why he would choose not to go back. I like this one more because it's like, you haven't seen your wife. Like, that's kind of... or your children. It's kind of messed up to be like, ew, I don't want to be around my kids. They stink. Like, that's... that's, right. Like, going to leave a bad taste in your mouth. But this, which is just like, I'm not this culture anymore. I don't really belong somewhere, but I feel like I belong here more than there. That, I like that a lot more. So, thank you, Shannon, for cleaning it up.
Yeah.
They really set this moment up really well, you know, because... we have seen multiple rounds of the tea house interactions, Keiku, and it's just so elegant, like an art. And we see this woman with his crew and they're just being so like abrasive and messy with her. And she's saying no. And so the consent stuff is, you know, there's a misalignment in that. And it's just like, it's just so dirty and wrong. And so I loved that big contrast because they already downloaded in me multiple times the beautiful elegance of intimacy, you know, from the tea house. So that was really impactful.
But in the last episode, right, our Lady Ging, she, you know, really did emphasize like how it's not like a beautiful thing. They try to maintain their dignity as best as they can, but she did say like she didn't, when she talked about it, she wasn't like romanticizing it. So,
oh no, definitely not. Because she's created something new and different and beautiful that is protecting them as women. And she's like part of that. But that's all that we've gotten downloaded. Right. But that's all we've gotten on this piece, like so far. And then this episode and this scene is the first introduction that they're giving us the raw, like reality. So we get that same shock with Blackthorn.
I guess because I like this, like Western culture. So I, like, it wasn't so shocking to me, but, it is different. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is like, either way, like it's not consensual. In either situation, it's just like some are expressive and some are not. But at the end of the day, I feel like the women and the courtesans, like they're still completely property. And I don't know, maybe even this version is better because like maybe the women like can at least express themselves a little bit or say no, you know, because you can't really say no as a courtesan. They're more like capital punishment.
No, they can't say no.
You're allowed to be sloppy with these dirty white men.
I acknowledge all of that. I get all that and I know all of that part. I was just saying from like the writing perspective of the journey how they set us up to feel the contrast with Blackthorn and really kind of being in his shoes. We've kind of have forgotten a bit about like this piece because we haven't been watching it. So I was just saying it from like the writing perspective and how they've portrayed it. And then this like stark, like... immersion.
Yeah, I mean, Blackthorn's been pinning a lot on this concept of getting my men, getting my boat, getting out of here. And then he gets the men and he's like, ugh, no, thank you.
Never mind.
Right. And so the very next scene is meeting Yabu to be like, well, let's see if we can get something cooking here. Because my men, that's a non-starter.
Right, except though, like in that scene though, I thought it was super important though that we need to have perspective from them. Like it's, you know, I gave us like the context of their journey getting here. That's not something that they included in the show. And so when this sailor like brings this up to him, like that the men like hate him because he ruined their lives. He took them away. Like he went rogue. I mean, I think it added really great perspective too, that like they never had a choice because he's the navigator. And so they didn't have a choice like to go further to, you know, get to the Americas and then Africa and then, or Africa and then the Americas and then here. So I thought that it added really great depth to Blackthorn as well, because he obviously did this thing that like he shouldn't have done and he's not a hero to his people. And I mean, he got some baths, but they're still like his people. And so I think it was really nice that they spoke up for these nine sailors or six sailors left. Like, six what left, are they supposed to do? Yeah, they have nothing, right? They don't speak the language. They're not getting tutored for the language. Like, they...
The locals ate them.
I guess they know Portuguese, right?
Yes.
But maybe some of them don't because they're just sailors. Like, I don't know. I don't know their education. I think,
what were they, Dutch?
Dutch, yeah.
Yeah, they're Dutch. But, like, Anjan knew Portuguese because he was, like, well-versed and had a lot more experience. So these guys, like, if they just know Dutch, like, they're lost. And there's no way that they can even, like, have enough crewmates to, like, make it back. And then on top of that, they don't even want to make it back because they're scared to die since they almost died coming here. So this was a short scene, but I thought it was significant for who Blackthorn really is, and that, like, he is kind of a piece of shit. And even though these guys smell bad, like, they still really got a short end of a stick.
Yeah, that's why he was punching him in the face. He's just punching his shame.
Right. Yeah, that was, like, really impactful and intense. I mean, he was his shame, but also, like, his repression, right, from that he's been learning and gaining from the Japanese culture. Like, he has to keep it together and he's been super confused and scared. And so he really let it out on this poor sailor here.
Interesting to couple this scene in the same episode as getting the rudders back. Both things are representations of pre-Japan Blackthorn. Maybe that getting the book back was kind of serving up emotionally that shittiness of his misdeeds in his history emotionally, you know, for him. And he's, so it's kind of on the surface there. He's been thinking about it. Oh yeah, there's this book of all the bad things and raping and pillaging I've done.
Yeah, and then this guy who's putting it in his face too. Yeah, right. But then right after this, where did we go?
Yabu's house. Whose house? Yabu's house. Do you think Yabu would have made a deal right then if he wasn't getting the stink eye?
Well, I think so. What do you think, Dennis?
He's always evaluating what's the thing that's going to keep me alive. So I think maybe he could have, but there wasn't enough weight in his, like, his survivability past it. I don't know if it was necessarily, you know, Omi stink eye that did it. I think it was just like, you know, I think if he knew that he can get away with it, even with Omi there, he would have said it. But I think because he just knew that the current state of stuff is just not the right time.
Well, first of all, he probably didn't want to do it right off the bat because he likes having that powerful position where he's like, oh, you're coming back to me? Like, sorry, sucker, because it has been like a pissing contest with them.
Right, yeah.
But then I think in addition, he probably, like, there's just too many people around. Like, there are people sitting outside right now. You don't want to be advertising that you're a traitor. So, which, like, he did make whatever arrangement with him outside of this. So yeah, I think that he's just way smarter than that. And the reason he decided not to pursue anything in this scene was because there's just too many ears.
Well, and to be fair, he hadn't seen Hiramatsu kill himself yet. Still, I think you're right. I think you're right. Yeah. It was an attractive idea, but the concept of being the one to take it away and then offer it back later makes him feel powerful. Like, he, even though he's an, like he says, an ally later to Blackthorn, he still wants that upper hand.
Yeah, he was probably impressed with Blackthorn's entire speech too. He did feel really good about himself.
Making your own fate.
Yeah, I loved him in this scene. He's so adorable. And Blackthorn was very desperate, and Mariko is so incredibly loyal to Torunaga, so I just don't think that, like, having her around is a good thing when you're trying to make deals. But I think at this point, he also thought that surely Torunaga would have a plan. So I think, yeah, that's probably what it was. He just didn't believe it yet.
Yeah, with the exception of their romance, Mariko tells Torunaga everything else that they do, that Blackthorn does. So, yeah.
I just like, you know, Blackthorn calling Yabu a brave shitface. It was like fun scene. It was just because, like Gabby said, right, the pissing contest has been going since episode one, and that acknowledgement and that respect that, like, solidified, okay, well, like, I respect you, so I'm going, like, just, even though we know you're a psycho. And so it's just funny that his full circle with Yabu is the irony that Yabu terrorized him and his crew foiled one of his guys, and now Blackthorn sees his own men as barbaric, ironically. And I really loved that this was the contrast right with the tea ceremony kind of thing. I already mentioned that piece of it, but yeah, I just really love this dynamic, and I'm excited to kind of see like how they play out on the ship together.
Yeah, and Mari goes, quotable quote, that once loyalty begins, it does not end. Otherwise, it wouldn't be loyalty.
She's got a point.
So it's fun because so far the women are the only ones who have actually been loyal from beginning to end other than Hiromatsu. So ladies are the ones with the wisdom. They walk the walk and they talk the talk and walk the walk.
How do you suppose Lady Gin learned of the allotment for her to start dreaming up her Edo tea house if that was put into Torunaga's will and he hasn't actually died yet? Is she just like manifesting? Like, well, the writing's on the wall, so I might as well start planning where I'm going to put the various rooms, and et cetera.
I think I just assumed that he granted it, that he just granted it already.
Oh, is that it?
Not that he had to will it, like, for like when I die. I think I assumed that because they went to all visit the land and they're having real emotions and executing it, that he authorized them to go ahead and break ground.
Yeah, I think she's just, they just said, hey, when this does happen, this is going to be your land. Because someone else did take her there, right?
She had a group with her, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that everyone knows what's to come, and maybe it is implied that like she'll get it anyway. Because everyone thinks he's like sick and dying, so that's probably part of the ruse. Yeah, because he's about to go surrender, so they know that he's going to die. So, like, yeah, may as well just start planning it now.
Get a jump on things.
Yeah, and I think it was, like, 2 chos, and that's, like, 2-point-something acres. Like, is a cho, so she got, like...
Yeah, you could put a pretty big tea house on there.
Yeah.
It was really beautiful seeing these poised women, like, out there and
in the distance.
Shitty weather.
But, like, it's shitty weather, but like they were like, the rain was falling. Nobody was trying to like hide the rain from falling on their face. Like they were just like in the rain.
They were imperfect.
And they were imperfect. And she was barefooted in the mud and just like smiling. In bliss. And so, yeah. And Gabby mentioned, I think it was the last episode, about what rain means in Japanese culture, right? Renewal and growth. This was like a perfect representation of that.
With a joke thrown in with the church next door.
Yeah, that was beautiful. That was wonderful. I loved that.
It was really cute. Yeah, he, like having his vantage point where he was looking out and those ladies were poised looking in the opposite direction. Because, yeah, we haven't seen any scenes like this, like the openness like that. Like, he looks really scared and worried. So I was thinking, what is he scared of? Is he scared that, like, his people are going to try and, like, be scandalous and go over there? Or was he just, like, I don't think he was just disgusted by it. I think it was more of just, like, this doesn't look good. Or I'm going to have a challenge with our dudes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that seems like the sort of thing that he would raise at the right time to see if maybe another plot of land was available or if there had been some sort of mistake at the, I don't know, the Edo zoning office. This isn't zoned for brothels.
And that's when zones were created.
Exactly.
That's funny. I mean, shortly after this, there were a lot of significant scenes that were just like staccato back to back. Like they were like fresh. So right after this is where we saw more of Lady Ochiba, right?
Accompanying the dying wife of the Taiko, yes.
Yeah, once again, she's scared in this scene. At least I saw she was like scared and sad, which is a side of her we have not witnessed yet.
Well, I would suppose that a wife can treat consorts any way she wants. And this wife treated this consort respectfully. So... knowing how that could have gone and what did actually happen, I'm sure there must have been some gratitude toward her.
Yeah.
Affection.
And she said, look at what I created. She took like ownership of her, like she was a daughter. And she said, our child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She said, our child. And then look what I created. And she was like caressing her face, Lady Ochiba's face. So I thought that she was mentioning her child when she said, our child. they were mentioning little Tycho, but then when she made that last, like, look what I made, and she was caressing Lady Ochiba, I feel like that was one thing of, like, I've always seen you as a daughter. And yeah, that's probably why Lady Ochiba had extra sadness.
What do you suppose about the advice about Ishido is just peasant, don't hook up with him, and how that plays out later?
I mean, these writers are really great at foreshadowing. And so I do think that there's going to be a flip-flop. So whether it's going to be Saiki or Lady Ochiba, I think it's going to be one of them or both of them, I think, that are going to be pro-Torunaga. And I don't know. It's making me think that it's going to be her somehow.
Yeah, that line, Ishido comes from nothing and is nothing, was a really powerful statement, and it reveals his real motive. So I think, like, behind the charming stuff of, like, oh, I always liked you and I always admired you, he's really, his own ambition is to himself. So this was just showing where his real intention is rooted.
Well, from there, we finally get to that big fat meeting. Calls in all the guys, and he's continuing to act very ill, Torunaga is. And he passes around the list of who's going to sign up to surrender with me. That's like his big test of who's actually loyal to me versus some other idea. Plenty of guys, it turns out, have some questions about just giving up like this.
Yeah, and Yabu was the first one to sign. He signed it right away. I don't know if he rolled his eyes when he grabbed the pen and then went to sign it. I felt like he made a face, but I don't know if it was, I feel like it was kind of like a, okay, great, this is happening, whatever, sucks to suck. That's what I got. And then right after that, Omi, like, super hesitated and was shaking when he was doing it. So yeah, it was pretty cool seeing everyone's true feelings. Did you expect that?
No.
What did you expect from this episode, from this scene?
I did expect someone to die there, but not Hiromatsu, because he is still valued as a general and leader of men. But I think dramatically and narratively, him dying right here serves a better purpose for the overall story than it did in the book. So, I mean, I agree with the change. I think it's a bold, terrific change, but I did not see it coming at all.
I thought that Naga was going to be that's what we talked about in the last episode, was that he was going to be used for stalling, right? Because they have to have the ceremony, but also that he would be somehow used as leverage for showing Ishido. I think you're the one who said, like, if his head shows up in a box. So anyway, I was hoping that that's where it would end. So I was totally in denial the whole time. I was visibly bothered and just really talking to the screen in this scene. Just like, no, it's not going to happen. No, oh my gosh, Buntaro is the second. Like, this is so messed up. Like, Buntaro is already, like, the most depressed, angry person ever. And now you're going to be like, hey, kill your dad in front of all your friends. Like, this is so terrible.
After he got denied that he couldn't also die.
Oh my God, oh, yeah. Right? And then his woman... Oh my gosh. It was just, good job, Buntaro. I'm Team Buntaro right now.
Yeah, I was like, the whole time that this was happening, my hands were just like glued to my mouth. And I think I held my breath for like all of it. I was just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I was just like, It was unexpected. I didn't see it coming. And I know at the start of this podcast, I said, like, you know, I think maybe that this is like Torunaga's like plan and he's kept himself. But Paul, you mentioned that in the book, they did have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. So now as I'm reflecting back on some of the subtle things that I saw, there was a moment when they made eye contact where it was kind of like the most subtle eye movement that kind of was like a nod. And then that was when Hiromatsu stabbed himself and continued with the seppuku. So I think that now I'm interpreting that the eye contact and that nod was their communication of this unspoken plan that we haven't seen. So I've changed my stance.
Or like was spoken, but unspoken to us?
Off screen, yeah.
Yeah, so Oh my gosh. So I was confused at this scene as far as like, does he really is like, I couldn't believe that he was actually doubting Toranaga. And then when he said, like, I stood by your side since you were a piss dripping boy, that to me, I was like, no, like this is on purpose. Like that's, it was just too much. Like I was just too close. He's like his dad. Like that was too endearing and too intimate for it to just be like, I don't trust you, so I'm going to do this because you're wrong. It was too conflicting. And I was at that line. It made me laugh a little bit that he brought it up again. And then I was immediately just like really mad and angry and disappointed that now they're going to use our guy.
So you do believe in pointless death.
They don't, exactly. And that's where I was going with that. He has such a big purpose here. Gosh, Toranaga is really good at getting people to like seppuku for purpose. I mean, maybe that I know, I understand. Like, that's just how it is and it was, but it's just so terrible to watch over and over again. It's like I love all these people.
It is like a chess game, and he's giving away major pieces. His son wasn't a pawn.
True.
Hiramatsu wasn't a pawn. And he's getting something out of those losses, but they're still losses. He still has less, you know, assets to do what he needs to do. But he buys things with those. In this case, he buys this gigantic misdirect of his surrender.
Very powerful scene. And we saw a different level of sadness in Toranaga as it's happening. And they maintained such intense eye contact. This was hard. This was a hard one to watch for me, for sure. Gosh, what is the next freaking episode gonna be?
Mariko's death.
Oh my god.
Right.
We're just going for your soul now, Gabby.
I know. I cried during this scene. I did. And I had an audience and I was holding a crying baby and all that didn't matter because I was just zoned in and sobbing.
Major scene, really dramatic stuff.
I don't want to watch anymore, Paul. Like, and the worst part is like, I know how it actually ends in real life, right? Like, this is a hero to these people, the great unifier. He brought peace, and so all of this is for a greater good. And it's like, I get it, I know. Let's not talk about it anymore. Like, I don't need to see my loves on screen.
Did it help at all to get the scene right following that, where he does let you know that he does have a plan? He's not actually surrendering, but there's still...
Of course not.
It didn't help at all?
No, not at all. Because I knew it.
They're still dead, Paul. Hinamatsu's still dead. It doesn't make it better.
Yeah. And now our girl is next. It's like, I'm a denial person, okay, Paul? Like, it's like I have my suspicions, but then when you throw it in my face, I'm emotional. So this is like my favorite show. It has to be because it really I'm just obsessed with everything. It's perfect. I go on a ride like crazy every single time. Our love, Toranaga, was really teary-eyed at the end of these scenes. I'm just so proud of everybody who's part of this. And I'm so happy because it must feel incredible to be part of something like this. And it's almost over, you know, it's coming to its end. And so I just can't imagine like what victory they're going to feel, what the victory they already felt, like everyone part of this cast and crew and production, like in, you know, wrapping up and then in, you know, their finale. It's just, I'm going to be sobbing, and I'm already just really, really happy for this masterpiece that they've all taken a part in creating.
Well, the final few scenes we've already touched on in other discussions. We know that Ochiba says yes. We know that Yabu decides to take on Blackthorn. And we know that Toranaga eventually does go visit Naga's remains at the cremation site. Is there anything about those remaining scenes that stood out to you guys that you want to discuss?
Well, I just want to say that one of my favorite parts in that scene was when Yabu was breaking down the Japanese language for Blackthorn to understand him, where it says allies, you and me or something. But it sounded like to me that the word allies sounded like me and you, but like a little bit like kind of joined together. And it sounded like me and you sounded like there. That was the Japanese word for allies. And I liked that because I was like, oh, me and you, we are now allies. So that was really cute.
So the Falcon Room scene where Mariko finally understood everything. It was, she's all that's left of the like super loyal people. And so it made me think, you know, Toranaga expected Yabu and Blackthorn to get together and go away. So now we only have Mariko, who's going to like have insight on anything for Toranaga. After she's gone, it's going to be completely up in the air. Like, we'll have no clues anymore as to what's going to happen next with Toranaga. So that's sad and neat and something to look forward to, as far as subtleties go in the next episode. Watching Lady Ochiba come in, her face did kind of look a little bit different. So it does make me, like, she was so scared, I think, in all of the scenes prior to this one. And so it was a really short scene, but really significant to me because I did think that, yeah, she came in, she walks into the room and she bows to him, which I guess is like saying yes to the proposal. And so I did feel like maybe behind her eyes, she does have something up her sleeve. And I think that she's going to take Taiko's wife's advice to an extent and somehow work with Toranaga, like make some kind of deal, because she's still a mother. She still cares about her child. And I think she knows that if her child is with Ishido, Ishido's just going to obviously like want the power. But also, I guess because he's like poor and inexperienced and a plaything, he's just going to let them die or let something happen to them, let something happen to little Taiko, and maybe then just kind of enslave her. So I feel like she's got something going on. And then finally, yeah, the last scene with Yabu and Blackthorn was adorable because Yabu's so happy. Like, see, the first episode versus this episode, like watching them side by side is just amazing to know that we've gone through so much to get here, right? Like the character development, it makes sense. None of us are thinking like, oh, this was too fast or questioning anything. It's just like such a great story. Everyone's arc at this point like is just magnificent, especially Omi, where again I feel like this scene is when we finally saw that he became man. Even though he is like young, naive, scared, he is still, I guess he and Mariko are like still loyal to Toranaga, which like Fuji would be too, and we can rely on our ladies and our sensitive men. Finally though, the cinematography in this scene, it's just really dark, and then there's like a little bit of warmth from the fire in their faces when they're talking to each other. And then, I don't know, just like kind of the imagery in this scene was really artistic to me because of all the fog and the single flames. We're finally seeing, you know, Toranaga's not here. These people here are like the main players. Mm-hmm. And it's like we're seeing them with the training wheels off. Daddy's let them go on their own and like fly, little birds. So where will you go? How will you do? And so it's interesting because now Toranaga knows that Mariko is loyal to him. And that's why he was really asking her the whole time, like, are you loyal to Blackthorn or me? Because I think he knew Blackthorn would do this. And so now that he knows that Mariko is loyal to him, it's going to be a really interesting dynamic moving forward, because I feel like we're going to have more distance between she and Blackthorn, which we haven't seen yet. And so it's going to be some fun, like, I feel like we're going to see manipulation or subtleties reading between the lines between the three of them. I have no idea about this lovemaking scene. I don't think it's going to happen, but yeah, I guess I hope it happens for them, but I don't think it'll happen. And then, sorry, finally, that was a really special scene at the very end where we get to watch Toranaga speak to his son, where he's finally, sadly, proud of his son, especially considering that he, like, is honoring him by putting him and Hiromatsu, like, in the same sentence, saying that he's not going to waste their lives and, like, passing. So lots of new dynamics with each of the characters, different vulnerability, different sides to them that we saw in these last few very like, not rushed scenes, but back-to-back diverse scenes. And yeah, the last one was really changed the tone, actually. It made me forget everything else and just focus on Todonaga and his plan. And yeah, I'm with you, man. Like, I was crying a second ago, but like now I'm all for what's coming. Like, he's very persuasive.
You don't get to be the big daimyo if you're not.
I know. You would think that he'd have more friends.
So I think I have some connections between what I'm seeing here and how the book kind of winds down. I think the main connection to think about that they've shown us on screen is the fact that Ishido has kept everybody in Osaka hostage, like all the regents, their families, etc. So I think it's fair to guess that when Yabu, Mariko, and Blackthorn arrive in Osaka, that is where they will stay until something major happens.
Yeah. Do you think that this next episode is going to be the battle?
No.
Or was that going to be the final one?
See, that's the funny thing. Here's a spoiler. The book, there's no battle. It totally sucks. I think that's what they're building up to in the show. That's going to be a big departure from the book, is they got to show what this was all worth. And that's not what happens in the book. So I'm really excited to see what that's going to look like.
Well, yeah. And episode 9 is named Crimson Sky. Remember that big old, that fight thing? we're back on. So
that old chestnut.
Look at you, context clues. Good job, detective. That would have answered my question. How exciting. I hope they're not just referencing it again.
They're like, we're going to psych you out. Crimson Sky. No, that's a flip-flop theme falling through.
Crimson Sky. No, no, no. Well, you know what? You know, in the credits, the intro credits, they have like those burning arrows hitting up that palace that's all destroyed. So let's hope it's next episode. And then after that, I don't even know. I don't even know. And I don't even care. I'm going to be just like gutted.
Just feed it to me. I don't care.
You're going to be Omi the rest of this season.
I am Omi. Yes. Call me Omi from now on.
Disapproving stink okay. eye.
Yes.
Like, this sucks.
Introduce me like that next time. We have Inez and disapproving stink guy. That's my new identity.
I'll do that. Well, guys, we've been chatting for 2 solid hours. Can you believe it?
These episodes have so much in them. It's hard to narrow it down without like doing it justice and praising the right things, because it is such a dense, complex piece of art. You can't help it.
I agree. It's so well made. We're sort of past what they used to call peak TV, when there was just so much good TV being produced. And we're past these strikes, which I don't know if you know, but Hollywood doesn't actually consider themselves like back yet. And there's the potential for more strikes to come in other craft areas. So no one's really like gearing up for any major production, because if like the production designers or set designers or whatever go on strike, then Hollywood is just as crippled as they were without the actors and the writers. I've mentioned all that to say, like, this kind of thing, we're not going to get a lot of this year, I don't think, in terms of like high quality, big money, super well-made stuff like we were getting just weekly or all the time on several different networks like 5 years ago. So we're lucky.
Lucky to have it. I don't even know what I would compare it to. Because like Rome is really like tries to be accurate and kind of real time, excellent high budget production, great acting. And but even then, I think this really surpasses it. So you're saying that we were in a peak, and I'm letting you know that I don't know when that was supposed to be. I don't know what group of good quality TV like is supposed to compare to this.
Think of the era when HBO was making hit after hit and Netflix came on and they started producing House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, those attention getting series that started to win all the awards. Oh, okay. And then there was just like a glut of things like that. Everybody, including like WGN, mm-hmm. started making their own serialized shows. There was just way too much to watch and it was all pretty good. Or a lot of it was pretty good. Now, with the strikes and the pandemic, we had a glut of like reality shows and other things. And like when the actors and the directors and the writers all got their deals made and their protections put in place and their pay structure changed, none of the other crafts did. So they're all like, this isn't going to stand. So yeah, there's a very likely halt in production coming this year too.
Okay, well then you know what? I'm okay with that because I can just rewatch this until that's over.
Just sort of desensitize yourself by watching it over and over again?
I will not desensitize myself. That is not who I am. It doesn't happen that way. I just keep refeeling it over and over again. But then at the end, it's going to be happy tears because at least this happened like a really, really long time ago. Centuries ago. And so I can, that's my desensitizing. And if I rewatch it over and over again, then at least my actors, I know that they're just fine and I can be happy about that and just praise them for all of their glory on my screen. So bring it on. Bring on the strikes. Good luck to you.
Well, you know, they deserve a fair wage too, right?
And yeah.
With that, if you liked our lengthy discussion this week, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or I guess it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us a rating and a comment. And if it's good, we'll read it on the podcast and everybody can bask in your kind words, including us. And that'd be great because other people would be able to find the podcast easily because that's how algorithms work. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse.